and the desperate clutch of those hands told a silent story of pain. Magnus had seen portraits like this before, the last images of the lost. He could tell even across the years how much effort it had cost the boy to sit for that portrait, for the comfort of loved ones who would live after he was gone. His pallid face had the distant look of one who had already taken too many steps along the path to death for him to be recalled. Magnus thought of James Herondale burning up with too much light, too much love, too much, too much, while the boy in the portrait was as lovely as a dying poet with the fragile beauty of a candle about to gutter out. On the ragged wallpaper that might once have been green and that had mutated to a grayish-green color like a sea flooded with waste were words written in the same dark brown as the stains on Tatiana's dress. Magnus had to admit to himself what that color was. Blood that had been spilled years since and yet never washed clean. The wallpaper was hanging off the walls in tatters. Magnus could make out only a word here and there on the remaining pieces. Pity. Regret. Infernal. The last sentence in the series was still legible. It read, "May God have mercy on our souls." Beneath this, written not in blood but cut through the wallpaper into the wall by what Magnus suspected was a different hand, were the words, "God has no mercy, and nor will I." Tatiana sank into an armchair, its upholstery worn and stained by the years, and Grace knelt at her adoptive mother's side on the grimy floor. She knelt daintily, delicately, her skirts billowing around her like the petals of a flower. Magnus supposed that it must have been a habit with her to come to rest in filth and rise from it, all outward appearance radiantly pure. "To business, then, madam," said Magnus. And he added silently to himself, "to leaving this house as soon as possible. Tell me exactly why you have need of my fabulous and unsurpassed powers, and what you would have me do." "You can already see, I trust," said Tatiana, "that my grace is in no need of spells to enhance her natural charms." Magnus looked at Grace, who was gazing at her hands linked in her lap. Perhaps she was already using spells. Perhaps she was simply beautiful. Magic or nature, they were much the same thing to Magnus. "I'm sure she's already an enchantress in her own right." Grace said nothing, only glanced up at him from under her lashes. It was a demurely devastating look. "I want something else from you, Warlock. I want you," Tatiana said slowly and distinctly, "to go out into the world and kill me 5 shadow hunters. I will tell you how it is to be done, and I will pay you most handsomely." Magnus was so astonished, he honestly believed he must have heard her incorrectly. "Shadow hunters?" he repeated. "Kill? Is my request so very strange? I have no love for the shadow hunters." "But, my dear madam, you are a shadow hunter." Tatiana Blackthorn folded her hand in her lap. "I am no such thing." Magnus stared at her for a long moment. "Ah," he said, "I beg your pardon. Would it be terribly uncivil of me to inquire what you do believe yourself to be? Do you think that you're a lampshade?" "I do not find your levity amusing." Magnus's tone was hushed as he said, "I beg your pardon again. Do you believe yourself to be a pianoforte?"
"Hold your tongue, Warlock, and do not talk of matters about which you know nothing."
Tatiana's hands were clenched suddenly, curled as tight as claws in the skirt of her once bright dress. The note of real agony in her voice was enough to silence Magnus, but she continued, "A shadow hunter is a warrior. A shadow hunter is born and trained to be a hand of God upon this earth, wiping it free of evil
That is what our legends say. That is what my father taught me. But my father taught me other things too. He decreed that I would not be trained as a shadow hunter. He told me that was not my place, that my place in life was to be the dutiful daughter of a warrior, and in time, the helpmeet of a noble warrior and the mother of warriors would carry on the glory of the shadow hunters for another generation.
Tatiana made a sweeping gesture to the words on the walls and the stains of the floor.
Such glory, she said, and laughed bitterly. My father and my family were disgraced, and my husband was torn apart in front of my eyes. Torn apart. I had one child, my beautiful boy, my Jesse. But he could not be trained to be a warrior. He was always so weak, so sickly. I begged them not to put the runes on him. I was certain that would kill him. But the shadow hunters held me back and held him down as they burned the marks into his flesh. He screamed and screamed. We all thought he would die then, but he did not. He held on for me, for his mama, but their cruelty damned him. Each year he grew sicker and weaker until it was too late. He was 16 when they told me he could not live.
Her hands moved restlessly as she spoke, from her gesture at the walls to plucking at her gown dyed with old, old blood. She touched her arms as if they still hurt from where she had been held back by the shadow hunters, and she toyed with a large ornate locket that hung around her neck. She opened and closed it, the tarnished metal gleaming between her fingers, and Magnus thought he saw a glimpse of a ghastly portrait. Her son again? He looked toward the picture on the wall, the pale young face, and calculated how old the child of Rupert Blackthorne's must have been when the man had died 25 years before. If Jesse Blackthorne had died when he was 16, then the boy must have been dead for 9 years, but perhaps a mother's mourning never ended.
I am aware that you have suffered greatly, Mrs. Blackthorne, said Magnus, as gently as he was able. But instead of some plot of vengeance through the senseless slaughter of shadow hunters, consider that there are many shadow hunters who desire nothing more than to help you and to ease your pain.
Indeed. Of whom do you speak? William Herondale?
And in Tatiana's mouth, hatred dripped from every syllable of Will's name.
Sneered at me because all I did was scream as my beloved died. But tell me, what else could I have done? What else had I ever been taught to do?
Tatiana's eyes were huge and poison green. Eyes with enough pain in them to eat away at a world and devour a soul.
Can you tell me, Warlock? Could William Herondale tell me? Can anyone tell me what I should have done when I did everything I was ever asked to do? My husband is dead. My father is dead. My brothers are lost, my home was stolen, and the Nephilim had no power to save my son. I was everything I was ever asked to be, and as my reward, my life was burned to ash. Do not speak to me of easing my pain. My pain is all that I have left. Do not speak to me of being a shadow hunter. I am not one of them. I refuse to be.
Very well, madam. You have made your anti-shadow hunter position amply clear, said Magnus. What I do not know is why you think I will help you get what you want. Magnus was many things, but he had never been a fool. The death of a few shadow hunters was not an aim in itself. If that were all she wanted, she would not have needed to go to Magnus. The only reason she could have to go to a warlock was if she wanted to use those deaths to alchemize shadow hunter lives into magic for a spell. It would be the darkest of dark spells, and the fact that Tatiana knew of it told Magnus this was not the first time she had turned to dark magic. What Tatiana Blackthorn, whose pain had eaten away at her like a wolf inside her breast, wanted from dark magic, Magnus did not know. He did not want to know what she had done with power in the past, and he certainly did not want her to have power that could be cataclysmic now. Tatiana frowned, a little puzzled frown that made her look like Benedict Lightwood's spoiled and cosseted daughter again. For money, of course. You imagine I would kill 5 people and leave untold power in your hands, said Magnus. For money? Tatiana waved a hand. Oh, don't try to drive the price up by aping your betters and pretending that you have any morals or tender feelings, demon spawn. Name a higher sum and be done with it. The hours of the night are precious to me, and I wish to waste no further time on one such as you. It was the casualness with which she spoke that was so chilling. Mad though Tatiana might have been, here she was not raving or bitter. She was simply working from the facts, as shadow hunters knew them, that a downworlder must be so entirely corrupt that she did not even dream he had a heart. Of course, the vast majority of shadow hunters thought of him as something less than human, and as far below the children of the angel as apes were below men. He might sometimes be useful, but he was a creature to be despised, used, then discarded, his touch avoided because it was unclean. He had been very useful to Will Herondale, after all. Will had not come to him searching for a friend, but a convenient source of magic. Even the best shadow hunters were not so different from the rest. Let me say to you what I said once in an entirely different context to Catherine the Great, Magnus declared. My dear lady, you cannot afford me. And also, please leave that horse alone. Good night. He made a bow and then made his way with some speed out of the room. As the door shut with a snap, he heard Tatiana's voice snapping to match it. Go. After him. He was not surprised to hear soft footsteps pattering after him down the stairs. Magnus turned from the front door and met Grace's eyes. Her footfalls were as light as a child's, but she did not look like a child. In that porcelain, pure face, her eyes were gray hollows, deep, alluring lakes with sirens in their depths. She met Magnus's eyes with a level gaze, and Magnus was reminded once again of Camille. It was remarkable that a girl who looked no more than 16 could rival a centuries-old vampire for self-possession. She had not had time to freeze past caring. There must, Magnus thought, be something behind all this ice. You will not return upstairs, I see, Grace said. You want no part of Mama's plan. It was not a question, and she did not sound shocked or curious. It did not seem unthinkable to her, then, that Magnus might have scruples. Perhaps the girl had qualms of conscience herself, but she was shut up here in this dark house with a madwoman. Nothing but bitterness poured into her ears from dusk to daybreak. Little wonder if she was different from other girls. Magnus felt regret suddenly for the way he had shuddered back from Grace. She was not much more than a child after all, and nobody knew better than he what it was like to be judged and shunned. He reached out to touch her arm. "Do you have somewhere else to go?" Magnus asked her. "Somewhere else," said Grace. "We reside mainly in Idris." "What I mean is, would she let you leave? Do you need help?" Grace moved with such speed that it was as if she were a bolt of lightning wrapped in muslin, the long gleaming blade flying from her skirt to her hand. She held the glittering point against Magnus's chest over his heart. Here was a shadow hunter, Magnus thought. Tatiana had learned something from the mistakes of her father.
She'd had the girl trained.
I'm no prisoner here.
No? Magnus asked. Then what are you?
Grace's awful, awe-inspiring eyes narrowed. They were glittering like the steel, and were, Magnus was sure, no less deadly.
I am my mother's blade.
Shadowhunters often died young and left children behind to be raised by others. That was nothing unusual. It was natural that such a ward taken into a Shadowhunter's home would think of and speak to their guardian as a parent. Magnus had thought nothing of it. Yet now it occurred to him that a child might be so grateful to be taken in that her loyalty would be fierce, that a girl raised by Tatiana Blackthorne might not wish for rescue. She might wish for nothing more than the fulfillment of her mother's dark plans.
Are you threatening me? Magnus said softly.
If you do not intend to help us, she said, then leave this house. Dawn is coming.
I am not a vampire, Magnus said. I shall not disappear with the light.
You will if I kill you before the sun comes up, said Grace. Who would miss one warlock?
And she smiled a wild smile that reminded him again of Camille, that potent blend of beauty and cruelty. He had fallen victim to it himself. He could only imagine again with growing horror what the effect would have been on James Herondale, a gentle boy who had been reared to believe that love, too, was gentle. James had given his heart to this girl, Magnus thought, and Magnus knew well enough from Edmund and Will what it meant when a Herondale gave his heart away. It was not a gift that could be returned. Tessa, Will, and Jem had raised James in love, and had surrounded him with love and the goodness it could produce. But they had given him no armor against the evil. They had wrapped his heart in silk and velvet, and then he had given it to Grace Blackthorne, and she had spun for it a cage of razor wire and broken glass, burned it to bits and blown away the remains. Another layer of ashes in this place of beautiful horrors. Magnus waved a hand behind his back, then stepped away from Grace's blade, away through the magically open door.
You will tell no one of what my mother asked of you tonight, said Grace, or I will ensure your destruction.
I believe you think you could, Magnus breathed. She was terrible and brilliant, like the light shining off the edge of a razor.
Oh, and by the way, I suspect that if James Herondale had known I was coming here, he would have sent his regards.
Grace lowered her sword. Nothing more. Its point rested gently on the ground. Her hand did not shake, and her lashes screened her eyes.
What do I care for James Herondale? She asked.
I thought you might. After all, a blade does not get to choose where it is pointed.
Grace looked up. Her eyes were still. Deep pools entirely unruffled.
A blade does not care, she told him.
Magnus turned and made his way past tangles of black roses and undergrowth down towards the rusted gates. He looked back at the manor only once, saw the wreck of what had been grand and gracious, and saw a curtain fluttering in a window high above, and the suggestion of a face. He wondered who was watching him go. He could warn Downworlders to steer clear of Tatiana and her endeavors. No matter what the price offered, no Downworlder would fail to listen to a warning against one of the Nephilim. Tatiana would raise no dark magic. Magnus could do that much, but he did not see a way to help James Herondale. Grace and Tatiana might have cast a spell on him, Magnus supposed. He would not put it past either of them, but he could not see why they would. What possible role could James Herondale have to play in whatever dark plot they were hatching? More likely the boy had simply fallen prey to her charms. Love was love. There was no spell to cure a broken heart that did not also destroy that heart's capacity for love forever.
And there was no reason for Magnus to tell Will and Tessa what he had learned. James's feelings for Grace were his secret to keep. Magnus had told the boy he would never betray his secrets. He had sworn it. He had never betrayed Will's confidence, and he would not betray James's now. What good would it do Will and Tessa to know the name of their son's pain and still have no remedy for it? He thought once more of Camille, and how it had hurt him to learn the truth about her, how he had struggled like a man crawling over knives not to know it, and finally, with even greater pain, had been forced to accept it. Magnus did not take such suffering lightly, but even mortals did not die of broken hearts. No matter how cruel Grace had been, he told himself James would heal, even though he was a Herondale. He opened the gates with his hands, thorns scratching his flesh, and he remembered again his first sight of Grace and the feeling he'd had of being faced with a predator. She was very different from Tessa, who had always steadied and anchored Will, softened his eyes into humor and his lips to gentleness. It would be ironic, Magnus thought, terribly and cruelly ironic, for one Herondale to be saved by love and another Herondale damned by it. He tried to shake off both the memory of Tessa and Will and the echo of Tatiana's condemning words. He had promised Tessa that he would return, but now he found all he wanted to do was escape. He did not want to care what Shadowhunters thought of him. He did not want to care what would become of them or their children. He had offered help to 3 shadow hunters this night. One of them had replied that he was beyond help, one had asked him to commit murder, and one had pointed a blade at him. His relationship of mutual distant tolerance with the White Laws of the New York Institute seemed suddenly alluring. He was part of Downworld New York and would have it no other way. He was glad he had left London. He discovered in himself a pang for New York and its brighter lights and fewer broken hearts.
"Where to?" asked the driver.
Magnus thought of the ship from Southampton to New York, of standing on the deck of the boat letting the sea air wash him clean of the musty air of London. He said, "I believe I'm going home."
The Rise of the Hotel du Mort by Cassandra Clare and Maureen Johnson. Read by Stephen Lunsford.
Late September, 1929. Magnus spotted the little vamp vampire right away. She was winding her way through the crowd, pausing for a moment for a quick shimmy by the band. She had perfectly bobbed hair, shiny black with a straight bang, just like Louise Brooks. She wore an electric blue dress with delicate dripping beadwork that skimmed her knees. In most ways, she looked exactly like a normal customer at Magnus's speakeasy, and she easily blended in with the 3 or 4 dozen people who packed onto his small dance floor. But there was something separate about her, something dreamy and strange. The music was fast, but she danced a sultry middle pace. Her skin was stark white, but not the dusty white from cosmetic powder. As she did her lonely little snake dance right in front of the saxophone player, she turned herself and made direct eye contact with Magnus. When she did so, 2 little half-fangs appeared against the bright red lip. Realizing they were out, she giggled and clapped a hand to her mouth. A moment later, they had retracted. Meanwhile, Alfie, who was now clinging to the bar for support, forged on with a story. "I told him... Magnus, you listening?" "Of course, Alfie," Magnus said. Alfie was a very handsome and entertaining regular with excellent taste in suits and a love of strong cocktails. He told very good stories and smiled very good smiles. He was a banker or something, a stockbroker, maybe. Everyone had something to do with money these days. "I told him, You can't take a boat up to your hotel room. And he said, of course I can. I'm a captain. And I said to him, one moment, Alfie. Something I need to attend to. I'm just getting to the best part. Just one moment, Magnus said again, patting his friend's arm. I'll be right back. Alfie followed the track of Magnus's gaze and arrived at the girl. Now that's a tasty tomato, he said, nodding. But I didn't think that was your taste. My tastes are universal, Magnus replied with a smile. Well, get a wiggle on. She won't be here all night. I'll watch the bar for you. Alfie slapped the bar. You can trust me. Magnus nodded to Max, his excellent bartender, and Max immediately made another south side for Alfie. To keep your whistle wet while I'm gone.
Very kind, Alfie said, nodding. You're an egg. Dry.
Magnus called his bar Mr. Dry's. America was technically now all dry, alcohol being illegal everywhere. But the truth was, most places were wet, awash with the stuff. New York especially. Everyone in New York drank, and the fact that they now did so illegally only made it better. The speakeasy, as far as Magnus was concerned, was one of mankind's greatest achievements. Intimate, celebratory, illegal without being immoral. A frisson of danger without any real peril. Mr. Dry's was not a large place, speakeasies rarely were. By nature, they were secret. His was concealed behind the facade of a wig store on West 25th Street. To get in, you needed to say the password to his very efficient doorman, who viewed the prospective guests through a small slit panel in a reinforced door in the back wall of the shop. Once inside, you squeezed through a narrow hallway and entered Magnus's proud domain. 10 tables and a marble bar, imported from Paris, backed by a mahogany display of every elusive bottle of things exotic Magnus had been able to get his hands on. Most of the space went to his stage and dance floor. It pulsated under the pounding of dancing feet. In the morning it would be cleaned and waxed, and the scuff marks of 1,000 blows of dance shoes would be wiped away. He gently slipped through the dancers, most so intense and inebriated that they were unaware he was there. He enjoyed the soft and occasionally not-so-soft pummeling of flying limbs and kicking heels. He enjoyed feeling the body heat and being carried by the movement and the surge of the dancers as they more or less became one solid, pulsating mass. The little vampire was young, no more than 16, and she only came up to Magnus's chest height. He leaned down and spoke into her ear. "Perhaps I can buy you a drink," he said. "A private one, in the back?" The tips of the fangs popped out again when she smiled. Magnus already felt somewhat reassured. The half-fanged smile probably wasn't from hunger. Drunkenness could cause fangs to poke out a bit. But vampires, like mundanes, often sought after salty foods and amorous encounters when inebriated. "This way," he said, pushing back a curtain and revealing a short hallway leading to a single door. Right behind the main club, Magnus had constructed a small and intensely private room with a zinc bar. This room was lined in large stained glass panels, illuminated from behind with electric lights, portraying Dionysus, the Greek god of wine. This was where he kept the very best and very worst of his stock, and this is where he conducted his most private business. "I don't believe we've met before," he said, as she plopped happily onto a bar stool and spun around. "Oh, I know who you are. You're Magnus Bane." She had one of those New York accents that Magnus was still getting used to, even though he had been here for several months. It was brassy and big, like a blinking neon sign. Her kid leather dancing shoes had scuffed toes, and there was a mud stain halfway up the base of the heel, plus flecks of other substances that Magnus didn't want to know anything about. These were shoes for dancing, and shoes for hunting. "And what may I call you?" "Call me Dolly," she said. Magnus pulled a bottle of cold champagne out of the large tub of ice that contained at least 60 identical bottles. "I like this place," Dolly said. "It's got class."
"I'm glad you think so."
"Lots of places are classy," Dolly said, reaching into a jar on the bar and helping herself to some maraschino cherries, plucking them up with her long and probably dirty fingernails. "But they're fake classy, you know? This seems real classy. You got good wine. Like that stuff."
She indicated the cut-rate champagne Magnus was holding and pouring into a glass for her. The bottle, like others in the tub, was certainly nice, but they had all been filled with fizzed-up cheap wine and cunningly recorked. Vampires could drink quite a lot and could be expensive to have around, and he felt certain she would not be able to tell the difference. He was right. She drained half the glass in the first sip and held it out for a top-up. "Well, Dolly," Magnus said, refilling her glass, "I certainly don't care what you get up to on the street or anywhere else, but I do like my clientele. I consider it a matter of good service to make sure vampires don't eat them under my roof." "I didn't come here to eat," she said. "We go down to the Bowery for that. I was told to come down here and ask about you." The shoes did bear out the Bowery story. Those downtown streets could be filthy. "Oh, and who is so kind as to inquire about little me?"
"Nobody,"
the girl said. "Nobody," Magnus said, "is one of my favorite names." This caused the vampire girl to giggle and spin on her stool. She drained off the glass and held it out for more. Magnus refilled it once again.
"My friend..."
"Nobody?"
"Nobody, yeah. I just met him. This person, but this person is one of mine, you know?"
"A vampire."
"Right. Anyways, they want to tell you something," she said. "They said you gotta get out of New York."
"Oh, really? And why is that?" In reply, she giggled and half slid, half fell from the stool and broke into a shuffling and drunken private Charleston to the music that came pounding through the wall. "See," she said as she did her little dance, "things are about to get dangerous. Something about the Monday money and how it's an omen. See, it's all gonna break, a something, all the money. And when it does, it means that the world is going to end."
Magnus sighed internally.
The New York downworld was one of the most ridiculous places he had ever been, which was partly the reason he now spent his time serving illegal alcohol to mundanes. And still, he couldn't avoid this nonsense. People came to bars to talk, and so did downworlders. The werewolves were paranoid, the vampires were gossips, everyone had a story. Something was always about to happen. Something big. It was just part of the mood of the time. The mundanes were making absurd amounts of money on Wall Street and spending it on fripperies and moving pictures and booze. These were things Magnus could respect, but the downworld dealt in half-baked omens and pointless rivalries. Clans were fighting one another for control of small, inconsequential patches of ground. The Fae kept to themselves as ever, occasionally snatching the stray human from outside the Central Park casino and luring them down to their world with the promise of a party they would never forget. At least a pretty flapper vampire talking nonsense was better than a slobbering drunk werewolf. Magnus nodded as if listening and mentally counted the bottles of brandy and rum in the storage shelves below the bar. "These Mundies, see, they're trying to raise a demon."
"Mundanes do that all too frequently," Magnus said, moving a misplaced bottle of gold rum that had been put in with the spice. "Right now, they also enjoy sitting on the top of flagpoles and walking on the wings of airborne biplanes. This is the age of stupid hobbies."
"While these Mundies mean business."
"They always mean business, Dolly," Magnus said.
"It always ends messily. I've seen enough mundanes splattered on walls to last me..."
Suddenly a bell on the wall started ringing feverishly. This was followed by a loud, deep call from the main room.
"Raid!"
This was followed by a lot of screaming. "Excuse me a moment," Magnus said. He set the bottle of cheap champagne on the bar and indicated that Dolly should help herself, as he was sure she would even without permission. He went back through into the main bar, where an atmosphere of general madness had taken over. The band didn't pack up, but they had stopped playing. Some people were gulping back drinks, others running for the door, still others crying and panicking.
"Ladies and gentlemen," he called, "please simply set your drinks on the tables. All will be well. Remain seated."
Magnus had enough regulars now that there was somewhat of an established routine. These people were sitting down and cheerfully lighting cigarettes, barely turning to look at the axes that were already picking their way through the door.
"Lights!"
Magnus called dramatically. At once, the bar staff turned off all the lights, and the speakeasy was thrown into darkness, save for the glowing orange tips of cigarettes.
"Now please, everyone,"
Magnus said over the yells of police and the banging of the axe and the splintering of the wood, "if we could all count to three together. One..." They joined in nervously for two and three. There was a flash of blue, and then a final crack as the door came down and the police tumbled inside. Then, all at once, the lights came up again. But the speakeasy was gone. All the patrons found in front of them were porcelain teapots and cups of tea. The jazz band had been replaced by a string quartet, who immediately began playing soothing music. The bottles behind the bar were gone, replaced by a well-stocked bookshelf. Even the decor had changed. The walls were lined with bookshelves and velvet draperies, all concealing the bar and the stock of alcohol.
"Gentlemen," Magnus threw open his arms, "welcome to our tea and book circle. We were just about to discuss tonight's book, Jude the Obscure. You're just in time. I may have to ask you to pay for the door, but I understand the impulse. One simply mustn't be late to the discussion." The crowd began to fall about laughing. They waggled their teacups at the police and waved copies of the books. Magnus tried to vary this routine every time. Once, when the lights came back up, he had transformed the bar into an apiary, with buzzing beehives all around the room. Another time, it had become a prayer circle, with many of the guests wearing the garb of nuns and ministers. Usually this confused the police so much that the raids were brief and relatively non-violent, but each time he sensed their frustration growing. Tonight the group was led by McMantry, as crooked a cop as Magnus had ever met. Magnus had refused to pay him off on principle, and he was now coming down on Mr. Dry's bar. They had come prepared this time. Every officer had a tool, at least a dozen axes, just as many sledgehammers, crowbars, and even a shovel or two.
"Take them all," McMantry said. "Everyone goes in the wagon, and then take this joint apart."
Magnus waggled his fingers behind his back to conceal the blue light that webbed between them. At once, four panels fell away from the walls, revealing hallways and escape routes. His customers ran for them. They would come out in four different locations some blocks away. Just a bit of gentle protective magic. No one deserved to go to jail for having a cocktail. A few officers tried to follow, only to find the passages were suddenly blind. Magnus let the heavy glamour drop, and the speakeasy regained its normal appearance. This stunned the police long enough to allow him to slip behind a nearby curtain and glamour himself invisible. He walked right out of the bar, past the officers. He paused only for a moment to watch them pull back the curtain and study the wall behind, looking for the way to access the escape hatch they assumed had to be there. Back out on the street, it was a thick September night. New York often stayed hot this time of year, and New York humidity had its own special quality. The air was viscous, full of the murk of the East River, and the Hudson, and the sea, and the swamp, full of smoke and ash, full of the smell of every kind of cooking food, and the raw smell of gas. He walked down to one of the exit points, where an excited cluster of customers stood laughing and talking about what had just happened. This group was made up of some of his favorite regulars, including the handsome Alfie.
"Come on," Magnus said. "I think we should continue this at my place, don't you?"
A dozen people had agreed that this was an excellent idea. Magnus hailed a taxi and some of the others did the same. Soon there was a merry little chain of taxis ready to go. Just as one more person was squeezing into the back seat with Magnus, Dolly leaned in the window and spoke into his ear.
"Hey, Magnus," she said. "Don't forget. Watch the money."
Magnus gave her a polite, yes, whatever nod. And she giggled and tripped off. She was such a tiny thing, very pretty indeed, and very drunk. She would probably go off to the Bowery now and eat her fill on the city's less fortunate. Then the train of taxis began to move, and the entire party, which, from a glance out the back window, looked to have expanded by another dozen, made its way uptown to the Plaza Hotel. When Magnus woke the next morning, the first thing he noticed was the fact that it was much, much, much too bright. Someone really needed to get rid of the sun. Magnus quickly worked out that the excessive brightness was due to the fact that all the curtains seemed to be missing from the bedroom of his suite. He then noted the four fully dressed people sleeping around him on the bed, all oblivious to the sunlight and dead to the world. The third thing he noticed, perhaps the most puzzling, was the pile of car tires at the foot of the bed. It took Magnus a few moments and a number of strange contortions to get over the sleepers and out of his bed. There were easily 20 more sleeping and passed-out people all over the living room. The curtains were also missing from the windows of this room, but he could see where they had all gone. People were using them as blankets and improvised tenting. Alfie alone was awake, sitting on the sofa and looking out at the sunny day miserably.
Magnus, he groaned. Kill me, won't you?
Why, that's illegal, Magnus replied. And you know how I feel about breaking the law. And who were all these people? There weren't this many when I fell asleep. Alfie shrugged, indicating that the universe was mysterious and nothing would ever be fully understood.
I mean it, Alfie said. If you don't want to use that voodoo whatever, just hit me on the head with something. You gotta kill me.
I'll get you a bracer, Magnus said. Iced tomato juice and Tabasco, sliced grapefruits, and a plate of scrambled eggs. That's what we need. I'll have room service send up 2 dozen of each. He stumbled over a few people to the phone, only to find that he had actually reached for a large, decorative cigarette dispenser. It was possible he was not quite at his best either. And coffee, he added, setting this down and picking up the telephone receiver with tremendous dignity. I will order some of that as well. Magnus placed the order with room service, who had by now stopped questioning Mr. Bane's unusual needs for things like 24 plates of scrambled eggs and enough coffee to fill one of your larger bathtubs. He joined Alfie on the sofa and watched a few of his new guests turn and groan in their slumber.
I gotta stop this, Alfie said. I can't go on like this.
Alfie was clearly one of those people who turn maudlin after a good night out. Somehow, this only made him more attractive.
It's just a hangover, Alfie. It's more than that. You see, there's this girl.
Ah, Magnus said, nodding. You know, the quickest way to mend a broken heart is to get right back on the wagon.
Not for me, Alfie said. She was the only one. I make good money. I got everything I want, but I lost her. You see...
Oh no, a story. This was perhaps too maudlin and too much for the early hour, but handsome and heartbroken young men could occasionally be indulged. Magnus tried to look attentive. It was hard to do so over the glare of the sun and his desire to go back to sleep, but he tried. Alfie recounted the story of a girl named Louisa, something about a party and some confusion over a letter, and there was something about a dog and possibly a speedboat. It was either a speedboat or a mountain cabin. Those things are hard to mix up, but it really was much too early for this. Anyway, there was definitely a dog and a letter, and it all had ended in disaster and Alfie coming to Magnus's bar every night to drink away his sorrows. As the story lurched to its conclusion, Magnus saw the first of the sleepers on his floor start to show signs of life. Alfie did too, and he leaned in to speak to Magnus more privately.
Listen, Magnus, Alfie said, I know you can... do things.
This sounded promising.
I mean, Alfie struggled for a moment. You can do things that are natural.
This sounded very promising indeed, at least at first. However, Alfie's saucer-eyed expression indicated that this was not an amorous inquiry.
What do you mean? Magnus asked. I mean, Alfie lowered his voice further. You do those things you do. They're magic. I mean, they have to be. I don't believe in this stuff, but...
Magnus had maintained the premise that he was nothing but a showman. It was a premise that made sense, and most people were happy to accept it, but Alfie, an otherwise down-to-earth Mundy, appeared to have seen through it, which was attractive and worrying. What exactly are you asking me, Alfie?
I want her back, Magnus. There has to be a way.
Alfie.
Or help me forget. I bet you could do that.
Alfie. Magnus didn't really want to lie, but this was not a discussion he was going to get into. Not now, not here. Yet it seemed like he needed to say something.
Memories are important, he said. But it hurts, Magnus. Thinking about her makes me ache.
Magnus didn't really want this kind of thing this early in the morning. This talk of aching memories and wanting to forget. This conversation needed to end, now. I need a quick splash in the bath to restore myself. Let room service in, won't you? You'll feel better once you eat something. Magnus patted Alfie on the shoulder and made his way to the bathroom. He had to eject two more sleepers from the bathtub and the bathroom floor in order to engage in his ablutions. By the time he emerged, room service had produced six rolling tables laden with pitchers of tomato juice and all the eggs and grapefruit and coffee needed to make the morning bright again. Some of the near-dead sleeping around the suite had risen and were now noisily eating and drinking and comparing notes to see who was feeling the worst.
"Did you get our presents, Magnus?" one of the men said.
"I did, thank you. I'd been needing some spare tires."
"We got them off a police car to get them back for ruining a place."
"Very kind of you. Speaking of, I suppose I should go check on what's left of my establishment. The police didn't look happy last night." No one paid much attention when he left. They continued to eat and drink and talk and laugh over their suffering, and occasionally run to the bathroom to be ill. It was this way more or less every night and every morning. Strangers appeared in his hotel room, always a wreck after the previous night. In the morning, they stuck themselves back together again. They rubbed at raccoon-eyed faces full of smeared makeup, looked for lost hats and feathers and beads and phone numbers and shoes and hours. It wasn't a bad life. It wouldn't last, but nothing ever did. They would all be like Alfie in the end, crying on his sofa at dawn and regretting it all. Which is why Magnus stayed away from those kinds of problems. Keep moving. Keep dancing. Magnus whistled as he closed the door to his suite, and he doffed his hat to a very disapproving-looking older lady in the hall who heard the ruckus inside. By the time he had taken the elevator down to the lobby, he was in a good enough mood to tip the elevator operator $5. Magnus's good mood only lasted a few minutes. This taxi ride was considerably less merry than the last one. The sun was being obstinately bright, the taxi choked and sputtered, and the streets were more full of traffic than usual. Six cars across, all honking at once, all blowing noxious fumes through the window. Every police car he saw reminded him of the indignities he had suffered last night. When he reached 25th Street, the full extent of the destruction was immediately made clear. The door to the wig shop was broken and had been replaced, not very carefully, with a wooden board and a chain. Magnus opened this with a quick shot of blue light from his fingers and pulled the wood away. The wig shop had sustained fairly serious damage, displays overturned, wigs all over the floor, and a shallow wash of beer and wine, looking like strange sea life. The hidden door had been ripped completely off its hinges and was thrown across the room. He sloshed his way through the tight hallway, which had about 3 inches of mixed and souring alcohol pooled on the recessed floor. The head of this stream came trickling down the three steps that led up to the bar. This door was completely gone, reduced to splinters. Beyond that, Magnus saw only destruction. Shattered glass, broken tables, piles of debris. Even the innocent chandelier had been beaten down from its perch and lay in pieces on what was left of the dance floor. But this was not the worst of it. Sitting in the wreckage on one of three unbroken chairs was Aldous Nix, the High Warlock of Manhattan.
"Magnus," he said, "finally, I've been waiting for an hour."
Aldous was old even by warlock standards. He predated the calendar. Based on his recollections of things, the general consensus was that he was probably just under 2,000 years old. He had the appearance of a man maybe in his late 50s, with fine white beard and a neatly trimmed head of white hair. His mark was his clawed hands and feet. The feet were disguised by specially made boots, the hands by the fact that he almost always kept one pocketed and the other wrapped around the silver ball handle of a long black cane. That Aldous sat there in the middle of the wreckage was a sort of accusation.
"What have I done to deserve this honor?" Magnus said, carefully stepping onto the mess on the floor.
"Or have you always wanted to see a deconstructed bar? It is something of a spectacle." Aldous knocked a bit of broken bottle away with his cane.
"There's better business to be done, Magnus. Do you really want to spend your time selling illegal liquor to mundanes?"
"Yes."
"Bane, Aldous," Magnus said, "I've been involved in so many problems and battles. There is nothing wrong with wanting to live simply for a while and avoid trouble."
Aldous waved his hand at the wreckage.
"This isn't trouble," Magnus said. "Not real trouble. But it's also not a serious endeavor. There is nothing wrong with wanting to enjoy life a little. We have forever. Should we really spend all of it working?" It was a stupid question to ask. Aldous probably would spend all of eternity working. Magnus, you can't have failed to notice that things are changing. Things are afoot. The great mundane war. They always get into wars, Magnus said, picking up the bases of a dozen shattered wine glasses and setting them in a row. Not like that. Not so global. And they're approaching magic. They make light and sound. They communicate over distances. It doesn't worry you?
No, Magnus said. It doesn't.
So, you don't see it coming? Aldous, I've had a long night. What are you talking about?
It comes, Magnus. Aldous's voice was suddenly very deep. You can feel it all around. It's coming, and everything will break apart.
What's coming?
The break and the fall. The mundanes put their faith in their paper money, and when that turns to ash, the world will turn upside down.
Being a warlock certainly didn't preclude you from going a little funny in the head. In fact, being a warlock could easily make you go a little funny in the head. When the true weight of eternity really settled on you, usually in the middle of the night when you were alone, the weight could be unbearable. The knowledge that all would die and you would live on and on into some vast unknown future populated by who knew what. That everything would always keep falling away, and you would go on and on. Aldous had been thinking about it. He had the look.
Have a drink, Aldous, Magnus said compassionately. I keep a few special bottles hidden in a safe under the floor in the back. I have a Chateau Lafite Rothschild from 1818 that I've been saving for a sunny day.
You think that's the solution to everything, don't you, Bane? Drinking and dancing and making love. But I tell you this, something is coming, and we'd be fools to ignore it.
When have I ever claimed not to be a fool?
Magnus! Aldous stood suddenly and slammed the tip of his walking stick down, sending a flood of purple bolts crackling along the wreckage of the floor. Even when he was talking crazy, Aldous was a powerful warlock. Stick around for 2,000 years, you're bound to pick up a thing or two. When you decide to be serious, come and find me. But don't wait too long. I have a new residence at the Hotel Dumont on 116th Street. Magnus was left in the dripping remains of his bar, one downworlder coming in and talking a load of nonsense about omens and disaster was to be ignored, but having that followed by a visit from Aldous, who seemed to be saying much the same thing. Unless those two rumors were one and the same, and they had both originated with Aldous, who was not sounding like the voice of complete reason. That made sense, actually. The High Warlock of Manhattan gets a little strange, starts talking about doom and mundane money and disaster. Someone would pick up that story and carry it along, and like all stories, it would find its way to Magnus. Magnus tapped his fingers on the cracked marble of his once pristine bar. Time, he had noticed, moved more quickly these days. Aldous wasn't completely wrong about that. Time was like water, sometimes glacial and slow. The 1720s, never again. Sometimes a still pond, sometimes a gentle brook, and then a rushing river. And sometimes time was like vapor, vanishing even as you passed through it, draping everything in mist, refracting the light. That had been the 1920s. Even in fast times like these, Magnus could not instantly reopen his bar. He had to keep some pretense of normalcy. A few days, maybe a week. Maybe he would even clean it up the Monday way, by hiring people to come with buckets and wood and nails. Maybe he would even do it himself. It would probably do him good. So Magnus rolled up his sleeves and set to work, collecting broken glass, throwing broken chairs and tables into a pile. He got a mop and pushed along puddles of mixed booze and dirt and splinters. After a few hours of this, he grew tired and bored and snapped his fingers, setting the whole place to rights. Aldous's words still preyed on his mind. Something should be done. Someone should be told. Someone more responsible and interested than him should take over this concern, which, of course, meant only one group of people. Shadowhunters would not come to speakeasies. They respected the mundane law against alcohol, always so tedious with their, the law is hard, but it is the law.
This meant that Magnus had to take a trip to the Upper East Side, to the Institute. The grandeur of the Institute never failed to impress him, the way it towered high and mighty above everything else, timeless and unmoving in its gothic disapproval of all that was modern and changeable. Downworlders could not normally enter the Institute through the main door. The Sanctuary was their entrance. But Magnus was no ordinary Downworlder, and his connection to the Shadowhunters was long and well known. This didn't mean that he got a warm reception. The housekeeper, Edith, said nothing as she admitted him except, "Wait here." He was left in the foyer, where he eyed the fusty decorations with a critical eye. The Shadowhunters did love their burgundy wallpaper and rose-shaped lamps and their heavy furnishings. Time would never move quickly here. "Come on," Edith said, returning. Magnus followed her down the hall to a reception room, where Edgar Greymark, the head of the Institute, stood in front of a bookstand. "Edgar," Magnus said, nodding, "I see you've bowed to the pressure and installed a telephone." Magnus pointed to a telephone sitting on a small table in a dark corner, as if it was being punished for existing. "It's a damn nuisance. Have you heard the noise it makes? But you can speak to the other Institutes easily and get ice delivered, so..." He let the book he was reading close heavily. "What brings you to see us, Magnus?" he said. "I understand you've been running a drinking establishment, is that correct?" "Quite correct," Magnus said with a smile. "Though it currently might be more useful as a pile of kindling." Edgar didn't ask for an explanation of that remark, and Magnus didn't offer one. "You are aware that the sale of liquor is currently against the law," Edgar went on, "but I suppose that's why you enjoy it." "Everyone should have a hobby or two," Magnus said. "Mine just happens to include illegal trade, drinking, and carousing. I've heard of worse." "We tend to not have time for hobbies." "Shadowhunters, always better than you." "I'm here because I've heard things in this drinking establishment of mine, things about the downworld that you might want to know about." Magnus recounted everything he could think of, everything Aldous had said, including his odd demeanor. Edgar listened, his expression never changing. "You're basing this on the ramblings of Aldous Nix?" he said when Magnus had finished. "Everyone knows Aldous isn't himself these days." "I've lived longer than you," Magnus said. "My experience is wide, and I've learned to trust my instincts." "We do not act on instinct," Edgar said. "Either you have information or you do not." "Considering our long history, Edgar, I think that perhaps you should act on what I'm saying." "What would you have us do?" Magnus resented having to spell everything out. He had come to the Shadowhunters with information. It wasn't up to him to explain precisely how they should interpret it. "Speak to him, perhaps," Magnus said. "Do what you do best. Keep an eye out." "We're always watchful, Magnus." There was a slight edge of sarcasm to Edgar's tone that Magnus really did not appreciate. "We will bear all of this in mind. Thank you for coming to see us. Edith will show you out." He rang a bell, and the sour-faced Edith appeared in an instant to take the Downworlder out of her house. Before going to the Institute, Magnus had been resolved to do nothing, just pass on the information and get on with his endless life. But Edgar's dismissal of his concerns motivated him. Aldous said the Hotel Dumont was on 116th Street, which wasn't far at all. That was just up in Italian Harlem, perhaps a 20-minute walk away. Magnus set his course northward. New York was a place that changed very abruptly from neighborhood to neighborhood. The Upper East Side was moneyed and dignified to the point of pain, but as he went up, the houses got smaller, the driving more aggressive, and the horse carts more frequent. Above 100th Street, the children got more boisterous, playing stickball in the street and chasing one another as mothers shouted through windows. The feeling on these streets was altogether more pleasant. There was more of a family atmosphere, with good smells coming from the windows. And it was nice to see a neighborhood where not everyone had white skin. Harlem was the center of black culture and the best music in the entire world. It was the hottest, most cutting-edge place to be. Which, he supposed, was why someone had plopped down this grand monstrosity of a hotel. The Dumont didn't quite fit in with the brownstones and the shops and the restaurants, but the Dumont didn't look like the kind of place that cared if its neighbors liked it or not. It sat back a bit, on a small side street that may very well have been custom-made for it, It had a great colonnaded front with dozens of sash windows, all with drawn curtains. A pair of heavy metal doors were firmly closed. Magnus sat in the soda fountain across the street and decided to watch and wait. What he was waiting for, he wasn't sure. Something